are going to get started. I'm just so excited to have with us again Sue Eastgaard from the Youth Suicide Prevention Program, who's going to talk to us about suicide intervention and assessment. And like I said, there'll be a couple points along the way to stop and ask questions. Meanwhile, you can also use the chat feature there where you can type in a question, and then when we stop, Sue can look at those and answer those questions as well. So I'm not going to take up any more time, but I just want to really thank Sue for being here. We've had such a huge response from people really wanting this information in working with survivors, so we really appreciate the chance to have it. Here you go, Sue.
Okay, we're shifting headsets, so I feel like I'm a pilot on an airplane. So here we go. So hopefully, you're in and that you have seen the slide that I'm looking at, which just has pictures of three sad children. And I want to assure you today that I work for the Youth Suicide Prevention Program, but this conversation will be about suicide across the lifespan. I will talk about youth, but I'm not going to just focus on young people, because I know many of the clients that you're working with are adults who are experiencing suicidal behavior. A quick service announcement about the Youth Suicide Prevention Program. Again, the website's there. You're welcome to access information at any time about what we're doing, primarily education and training. We do work in local communities, and I have field staff across the state who are able to come into organizations and into schools and do education, both for clients as well as for providers. The last time we did that, you need me to talk louder. So I'm hoping that, and the other question that just popped up has to do with, did this chat, the slides change automatically? No, I'm going to be doing that for you. So you should be on the slide that has, again, my name and the title of the presentation and the three sad-looking or sadder-looking youth than we'd like them to look, and I'll move it ahead. It is my understanding from Jake and the organizers here at the Coalition is that, the recording of this presentation as well as the slides will be available to you on their website when we complete this training. We have done a training once before. Some of you may have heard me then. Some of you may have seen me at conferences in Wenatchee. I've been privileged enough to be invited several times. My hope here, and Jake and I talked about this a great deal when we planned it, is that we would get to more specificity around assessment and intervention and actually do some case examples and spend a fair amount of time on that, because that's where the knowledge and the practice comes into play. So I'm not going to review in the greatest depth around statistics, though I'm going to cover that quite quickly. You're welcome to ask questions, and I will, again, as Jake said, pause at a point so you can address those more, and we can address those more thoroughly. But I'm going to honor my commitment to actually get to assessment and intervention so you feel like you have some knowledge and skills when you leave this webinar. We've got 85 minutes, so off we go. I'm going to move ahead to, now you should be on a slide that says suicide, some explanations. In our country, in the United States, we experience one suicide every 17 minutes. So again, not just for young people, but across the lifespan, we experience a suicide that is declared as such on a death certificate. I want to just make a quick point on this, and that is there are probably, without a doubt, many more suicides that occur for which the medical examiner or coroner did not have clear evidence to cite it as such. Suicide is a very complicated issue. I'm sure that's nothing new to you. There typically is not just one single cause. There's many reasons why people die by suicide. We're going to look at some of those reasons, and particularly as we look at the issues around sexual assault and domestic violence. It is my very strong belief that suicide is not about wanting to die. Suicide is about wanting to end or escape pain. And for those people who are suicidal, it seems like the only option when there are when the pain is so serious. Many of our suicidal folks do not leave a note So we don't have a considerable amount of information about the causality. People don't articulate, I'm going to kill myself because of this or that. So many times we're left trying to figure it out. Why could this have happened? And many survivors, in my business, a survivor is someone who is a family or friend of a person who's died by suicide, and I appreciate that your use of survivors is a bit different. But a survivor, a family member or friend who has died by suicide, is just struggling with this issue of how do I make sense out of it? How do I understand? And sometimes as clinicians, as providers, as friends, as advocates, when a client or a person close to us dies, we also ask the same question. So you don't have to be biologically related to the person to feel that sense of, what did I miss? Am I a bad advocate because I didn't see this coming? Again, I want to reassure you, if you did not hear it earlier, these slides will be available on the website, the Washington Coalition for Domestic Violence. It will be on their website after we finish this presentation. So you'll have copies of it, and you can make those available to your colleagues and to your friends. You're going to be really smart, and you're going to take all this information and go to a party and talk about it. So so we're going to move to the next slide. Again, just looking at statistics, our Caucasian men in the United States are the highest group who die, who complete suicide. In terms of semantics, we talk about people who've died by suicide. We don't necessarily say that people committed suicide, or we don't talk about successful suicides. So if I personally were doing my job based on statistics, I probably should be working with older white men. And there are lots of reasons why it is that we are, struggling with this issue about how do we prioritize the program and the services that we do. And at this point, let me just say, it's easier. It's to get resources and money and an audience related to youth suicide. The second bullet refers to our gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and the Q stands for questioning youth. So those youth who are really struggling or simply out and feeling ostracized by their sexual orientation have very high rates of suicide. We also see that statistically in our Native American youth. Interesting, we don't necessarily see high rates of suicide in our GLBT adult men and women, and we don't actually see that in our Native American adult men and women. So there's something to me very important as we look at those disenfranchised youth, both in the Native American group as well as in our group of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered, and again, questioning, who are wondering, who am I, and is it okay to be who I am? We also know that our young women are very much more likely to end up in a hospital or into the attention of emergency room personnel as a result of deliberately self-harming. I'm going to stop just for a moment and tell you, this is like a little promo, that I will be doing another webinar in May, on the 7th of May. You may already have that announcement, and we're going to focus exclusively on understanding self-injurious behavior. Again, not just in youth, but in all folks. So if this is a behavior, which I'm sure it is, that you are seeing within your shelters and in your programs and with community folks, please feel free to join us for that session. I believe it's in the morning, but I know it's been promoted and advertised. It's May the 7th, and I will be back on. So when I'm talking about self-injury, I'm talking about intentional behaviors that cause harm, like burning, like cutting, like branding. So that, and we're going to talk about self-injury in those ways. This is not going to be in early May a class on eating disorders. It's not going to be necessarily about drug abuse, though you could and I could both suggest that self-injurious behavior falls into those categories. But we're mostly going to do self-inflicted injury related to hurting oneself, typically on one's arms or one's legs, and trying to sort out then in that webinar whether that's suicidal behavior or that's some other kind of behavior. In terms of The other, just in terms of risk groups, and again, this shouldn't surprise any of you, has to do with unemployed persons and the issues related to not having, in our culture at least, a sense of worth, of value. If you're not employed, if you don't have an income, therefore you must not be as worthy. And many of our depressed and suicidal people are often unemployed, and so many of the clients that you're working with are either unemployed or underemployed, or struggling with issues related to finding and keeping employment. I'm going to hold off on the question that just came up to me. I can read it. It has to do with postpartum, but I'm going to hold off on that and just move some of this data so I don't get lost in the data and not get to what we need to talk about in terms of assessment and intervention. So we're going to move to the next slide. Just want to speak to you a bit about methods, and in the United States, the number one way in which both men and women die by suicide is with a firearm. Could that be a hunting rifle? You bet. Could that be a revolver? You bet. So it is important as we, again, move farther ahead in terms of assessment and intervention that we know more about means. And I'll cover that as we go through those significantly important questions asking about what kind of plan. So firearms, guns. So 10-year-old girls using a gun to end their lives, 75-year-old men using guns to end their lives, the number one way. In terms of a suicide attempt, so I'm not trying to be tricky here, the second bullet reads suicidal behavior using drugs or poisons. So when I'm talking about behavior, it's usually not a completed suicide, and it's much more probable that women are going to use less lethal means like drugs and different kinds of drugs. Drano can be used, but also very commonly used these days is something that you may be aware of, oxycodone, that's legitimately prescribed by physicians for pain and often then misused and added to alcohol, and can create a very toxic cocktail. But many more women make suicide attempts, particularly with drugs or poisons, that result in some kind of injury or involvement in hospital and treatment. Finally, on this slide, let me just also say to you that the method by which people, a gun versus jumping in front of a bus, both could be very serious, and we need to be taking a look at more than just their method. And so as we get farther into this and look at assessment and the questions, again, that I'm going to have you learn, it's not just about how they're going to kill themselves, but we want to know a bit more about some of the other factors. So don't assume that a gun automatically means certain things or that jumping in front of a bus is a method, but it's not that serious. So the question that just popped up that I really honestly don't know the answer to has to do with, have we seen higher rates of suicide and suicidal behavior since the economy has changed, that we just don't know that kind of data this quickly. It takes a very long time for the powers to be in the government to, and at local, state, and national levels to provide data. It wouldn't surprise me, but in terms of increased rates of suicide, given the previous slide having to do with unemployment, I think people are incredibly anxious. I'm sure some of you are as well. We're worried about our funding for our programs. We're worrying about our personal funding. But can I, sort of emphatically say, yes, we've seen higher rates? No, I cannot. And it will take me some more time to sort of understand that. There have been times in the past where we've had economic crises, and we certainly see higher rates. So that's why I'm assuming historically we'll see this increase. Okay, we're going to move to the next slide as we look about and think about warning signs. And again, if there are statistical questions, I'm going to pause in about three slides. You can just right away ask me a bunch of questions, but I don't want to stop at this point. I want to begin to talk about what would we be looking for? What would we be listening for in terms of suicidal behavior? Suicide doesn't come just happen. It doesn't come out of the blue. There are reasons why people die by suicide. And typically what we have is what I think of as a platform of mental illness. That could include depression. that could include a diagnosis of bipolar illness, and some of you know more about what that means, but it used to be called manic depressive illness, but basically it's radical mood swings that interfere with functioning. So I just don't mean having a good day and a bad day. I mean how it is that those moods affect ability to work, ability to maintain friendships and family. So there's also the platform that we have to think about in terms of substance abuse. So many of our suicidal individuals also may have an underlying substance abuse issue. Was that preceded by depression? Did depression precede the substance abuse? It's a bit of a murky picture, but again, most people who are abusing substances, most people who are depressed, many people who are have bipolar illness don't go on to die by suicide. The good news in all of this is that depression is the most treatable of mental illnesses. And it is, I can be happy to talk to you about more about that, but as we think about medication and about treatment, there is hope there. In terms of the specific warning signs related to suicide, I want you to be listening for and paying attention to four or five really important pieces. One of them is simply the knowledge that you may or may not have, but we want to know, is the client, is the person that you are dealing with, have they made a prior suicide attempt? Prior behavior is a strong predictor of future or present behavior. You already know that. You know that from your own work as advocates and providers in the domestic violence and sexual assault field. So we want to take a look at this also in terms of suicide. So knowing that and asking, we'll ask more about that. Another blatant warning sign is just the talking about suicide. And young people are not unique in the fact that they are not necessarily direct. People across the lifespan are often not bold and clear and forthcoming always about, they don't necessarily say to you, gosh, I'm thinking about killing myself. They might say things like, I hate my life, I'd like to be dead. I'd like to be someplace else. I wish I could join someone in heaven. So when I say talking about suicide, I want you to be very broad in your understanding of that and know that, again, young people, old people, all people have a tremendous difficult time talking about suicide. We have many, many, many stigmas and judgment about the issue of suicide. The last time we did this webinar, we spent a fair amount of time just talking about kind of feelings and attitudes about the issue. It's a great conversation to have because I think our attitudes around this issue can color or impact the work we do with suicidal people. For some of us, we grew up in a faith culture that said suicide was a sin, that it's not right and that God doesn't believe in suicide. And so there's judgment sometimes in the faith community about that. In 1971, it was against the law in the state of Washington to kill yourself. So that, you know, the issue is, you know, what are we looking at in terms of what do people think about this? And many times as a culture, again, we prevent open conversation around that because people feel afraid that they're going to be judged unfairly or poorly or that you might treat them differently. So additionally, the third thing I want to talk about in terms of warning signs, or maybe I should go back, not only do people talk about suicide, but they often will make a plan, which is where you're going to come in, and we're going to spend, again, some more slides down the road looking at what are the specific questions that I'm going to need to be asking. The strong wish to die. It's one thing for a 16-year-old to talk about wanting to die and giving away, for example, prized possessions, another one of the bulleted comments there. It's very different if a senior, your father, my father at age 80-plus, who says, I won't be needing these things. Is that because he's intending to die or is that because he's giving things away. So pay attention in this third bulleted set of items to the age appropriateness, different for adolescents than it is for an older person, at least in terms of the issue of prized possessions. The fourth bullet there, really, really important. I just want to highlight again this issue, this platform that we think about in terms of suicidal behavior related to depression. And I suppose I should have mentioned this earlier, the issue of anxiety. And I think, without a doubt, anxiety is one of those factors that we underestimate its impactfulness. People, and again, our culture, our world right now, is feeling very anxious. Those folks you have in shelters and in domestic violence and sexual assault programs are anxious. They have lost their sense of control. And what do most of us want? We want to be in control. So I do think you have to just consider the folks you're working with at higher risk for some of the basic factors they're dealing with. And so pay attention in terms of behaviors, in terms of verbiage, the words they're using, as you listen to hopelessness, as you notice this withdrawal, that these people, as you've gotten to know them, tend to be rather talkative and engaging in conversation, and then for a couple days they show up or don't show up, or they don't talk as much, and you're worried about the change in that behavior. And finally on this list of warning signs is the issue related to drug and alcohol use and abuse. And many of our folks who are suicidal, again, because of that substance abuse platform, are self-medicating. They're trying to feel better, and they're trying to use the resources they can access and try to feel better. In addition, we're going to go to the next series of words. I was kidding with Jake when I came in this afternoon. This is a mnemonic. This is kind of a supposedly easy way of remembering some of the warning signs or some of the issues to pay attention to. It doesn't happen to personally work for me, but if people, our style of learning is very different. So across the country, what is currently being suggested is this mnemonic called IS Path warm, and simply what that is meaning is that each of those letters reflect sort of a warning sign or an issue to pay attention to. So as we will look down this list of words, the I standing for ideation, meaning is the person talking about suicide? The S, again, very high up there, is substance abuse. Are they using more than they have? Are they using to self-medicate because we want to? That's a danger. The P is path warm, has to do with purposelessness. What is the person's sort of attitude or statements about their life? My life has no purpose. What's the point of my life? The P is very important. The A for anxiety, we already talked about that. The T for a sense of feeling trapped. I can't get out of this situation. If I go back to him, I'll get beaten up, but if I don't go back to him, then what will happen to me and my children? I think many of the survivors that you're working with feel that profound sense of trap. There's not a good option, which leads to the H in path, that sense of hopelessness. And what I think is important, again, in the assessment has to do with, have they been feeling that way for a long time? Or is something more significant happened today that's increased that sense of hopelessness? Maybe you grew up with a mother like mine, but there was all these proverbs and special lessons, and one of the things that she always talked about was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I think a lot of the folks I'm working with and the folks you're working with who have long-term senses of frustration and anxiety, but something tilts that so it's worse. What is it that made it more a stronger feeling of trapped? What made it more hopeless? Then we move to the letters in the word warm, withdrawal, moving away from people, becoming more isolated, the A in anger. Many depressed people exhibit anger. They just are mad, they're frustrated, and they vent those feelings towards you and towards me and towards hotlines of all kinds. And we get mad at those people, and we don't like being treated that way. I'd like to invite you to think about those folks as also manifesting strong emotions that they don't know what else to do with, and it may be an underlying depression. It may be an underlying experience of suicide. The R in warm, standing for recklessness, just making poor decisions, sort of impulsivity. It could be unsafe, unprotected sex. It could be drinking and driving. It could be all sorts of things. But many suicidal folks experience a sense of what would it matter? You may or may not read about suicide by cop. And it's more of that that we read about in the paper. But I think many of our suicidal folks who die that way don't necessarily have the courage to kill themselves or turn the gun on themselves, but they're likely to force a situation, kind of really poor judgment, and recklessly ask for their life to end. I think it's terribly sad, and I wish more importantly that we could do something in advance. Then M in this mnemonic has to do with mood changes. How is it that their mood gone? Sometimes it goes from very dark to very happy, and we think, oh, yay, it's better. And yet sometimes we know, unfortunately, after the fact, that those people whose mood has improved radically can, in fact, have resolved their ambivalence about wanting to die and simply are at peace with their decisions. They put their affairs in order, they chop wood, they take care of things, and they say goodbye. Sometimes we see just the opposite. We see people who move from happy, more kind of regular moods to very dark and angry moods. So I just be aware of mood changes. And again, if this mnemonic works for you and you can remember what the I and the P and the T and the W stand for, more power to you. But I do think it's a very good summary of what we are looking for in terms of suicidal behavior. So what I want to do at this point is stop. There's a few questions that I have sitting in front of me, and you're more than welcome to either write them or you can unmute by pressing *6, which means not only I will hear your question, but everyone else will. So I'm not trying to intimidate you. I just want you to be clear of what's going to happen, and I can answer them either way. So I'm not going to talk for a minute. If there are questions from the beginning till now, write to me, type for me, and otherwise, then I'll go and answer those, and I'll answer the one more that's up here right now. Thank you. The first question comes, is, I think you all can read this, but maybe they can't. We don't know the technology all that well. Jake and I are looking at each other. The question was, do you find that victims of domestic violence are at greater risk of suicide? The answer clearly is yes, and if you have not seen the fatality review report that was written now 2.5 years ago, there's a very important chapter related to suicide, and we see a very strong correlation both for victims and for perpetrators. So the data that the folks here at the Coalition, as they began to look at not only perpetrators but victims of domestic violence and suicide victims, we do see a correlation. And if you just keep looking at this mnemonic that we have up on the screen, you can see how many possible of those behaviors or those manifestations of suicide risk that belong to, again, domestic violence victims. So I think you are absolutely working in a field with people at risk of suicide. I'm delighted that we have so many people on this call, because this is the training that many of us don't get, including those of us who've supposedly gone to a graduate school education. We just don't get this information. So bravo to you, and hopefully you will continue to learn and ask questions about how to assess and intervene. The next question that just popped up is, do you see negative interaction with institutional systems such as CPS, Child Protective Services, as a factor for suicide? Let's be honest. I think all of us probably have our hidden and not so hidden judgments about institutions like the police or about child protective services. I think that I don't want to be harsh and suggest that all institutions cause suicidal behavior. I think there's two factors going on. I think many institutional staff don't have knowledge and skills about how to deal with it. I think they're resource poor, so I don't think they have opportunities in this, which is what we need more and more of. And again, I don't think they have the adequate training. So yes, there are times that people are involved in the child protective system who sort of enhance or accentuate risk. I don't think they necessarily cause it. I think they perhaps add to kind of the volcano of issues that people are dealing with. Another question, you stated under groups that young women are most likely to cause self-harm. How do you define women, young women? So basically, where the highest statistics are in terms of self-injury are women 24, 25 years of age and younger. And we clearly see younger, like starting at 6, 7, and 8-year-old, both girls and boys, but much more commonly in our girls who are likely to make, again, self-injurious, the cutting, the burning, and we'll spend a lot more time on that at the May 7th webinar. The question that just popped up is this webinar available in text? Do we have it on PDF or pamphlet? We will, again, post the PowerPoint on the Washington Coalition Against Domestic Violence, their website. There are brochures, there are pamphlets on the Youth Suicide Prevention website, so that's, and it's on your slides. It's also at YSPP, the first letter of the words youthsuicidepreventionprogram.org, and you will see a fair amount of information about the issues. It's not presented in exactly the same way, but again, Jake has assured me that this webinar will go up on the internet. It's also being recorded, so there will be, in fact, availability in a number of different means. Another question, are there statistics available for the rates of suicide among children of domestic violence? It's a great question. The problem is, the answer is no. In our state, we do not collect a great deal of data related to death other than kind of gender when it's obvious, age, method of death, name. So what is on a death certificate is basically the sources of information I have. We used to, now 5-6 years ago, have something called Child Death Review, and in some count, the state funding for that went away. You may or may not have that in your own communities. There are, for example, Pierce County still does Child Death Review, Kitsap does some, King does to some extent, but those counties do look at unexpected deaths of youth from 0 to 18. So in the process of meeting and kind of doing a autopsy, if you will, but it's not in the sense that it's on CSI or on television, but more of an autopsy of trying to understand why did this drowning occur, why did this baby, this infant die in the crib, why did this 14-year-old die by suicide, there's a whole lot of uncovering of some of the precipitating or underlying explanations, and I would be not surprised that they unearth issues related to domestic violence and children of domestic violence, but sadly, the state is no longer collecting that data because the funding went away for that. So if you are interested in your local data, the first place to go would be to your public health department and ask, do we have a child death review, and do you have any, if so, do you have any data on what we know about our victims of domestic violence, our survivors of domestic violence? I don't know, I'm looking at Jake right now, whether the fatality review has looked at children in related to suicide, and he's shaking his head. So again, and your fatality review report is on your website. So the one that was done, not this recently, but two and a half years ago, has a 2006 has a section on suicide. Please take a look at that if you're interested. I think there's some really important data, and I was asked to comment on it, and totally am in support of the fact that we have these commonalities and need to do more of this cross-training. The final question, then I'm going to move ahead to the next section. Again, when we were looking at the slide related to groups, what I put up there was GLBTQ, and the G stands for gay, the L stands for lesbian, the B stands for bisexual, the T stands for transgendered, and the Q stands for questioning. So sometimes you see the language GLBTQ, sometimes you see it LGBTQ. I don't want to, now occasionally people are adding an I to the end, so there's a, anyway, just know that we're talking about people who are primarily dealing with issues of sexual orientation or gender orientation, but high-risk group related to primarily people who are often harassed, abused, maligned because of who they are or who they are choosing to be, which puts them at very high risk for suicide. Okay, we're going to move ahead because I'm going to stay true to my word and keep to assessment, and I love your questions, and we will keep grinding ahead. So as we look at issues of, you know, so what do I do? What if I have a child that whose mother is suicidal? What if I have a mother who's suicidal? What if I have a, anyway, so I want you to understand that we're going to look at strategies about what you can say and do when you are concerned about a person at risk of suicide. What's not on here, and I want you to really hear this, is that you need to get involved. So even though you don't feel like you have perhaps a counseling degree, or you don't have the, what, you know, you don't have all the skills, you didn't go to a graduate school program, or even if you did, you know, please understand that you, as an advocate, as a frontline, what I call a gatekeeper, needs to be able to do what I'm asking you to do. You're not going to cause someone to be suicidal. You're going to really open up the opportunity to talk about something that you may be nervous about, but you can only imagine how much more nervous the person at risk is. So the first thing you're going to do is to be able to show that person that you care about them. So, again, I want you to be able to say things like, I'm concerned about you. I'm concerned about how you feel. Tell me what's making you so sad. And you do this all the time. You do this when you're, you know, engaged with clients. I'm just reminding you how important this is in dealing with the person who is at risk or may be at risk, but you don't even know that for sure. So first and foremost, show you care. A couple of things that are on the slide that I want to talk about. I want to talk about where you have that conversation. So if you are concerned about somebody in your shelter and there's five other women sitting around, it's really important that you not engage in this conversation when everybody else could hear the conversation, because the likelihood is that someone's not going to disclose that. I think it's really important that you show you care primarily by listening, maybe asking one question and waiting for a response. I tease parents a lot, but many of us ask our children multiple questions without waiting for the answer to the first one. Maybe some of you are guilty, like I am, of asking a thing like, you know, how was your day at school, honey? Do you have any homework? The truth is there are two questions in there. If I said to you, you know, how you liking the webinar, was it hard to get on, there are two questions on there. So when you are dealing with people who are in crisis, and I would suggest any kind of crisis, we need to slow down and we need to ask a question and wait for the response. In suicide, it's even more important because we start getting nervous, and if you're like me, when I'm nervous, I talk more. I'm much more likely to try to fill in the gaps and say a whole bunch of stuff. So I really want you to slow down, ask a question, wait for the answer. And the other thing, there are many, but the other really important thing that I think we can do to show that we care has to do with avoiding questions or inquiries that start with why. Why are you depressed? Why do you look so sad? Why are you behaving that way? All those questions lead to people feeling potentially guilt-ridden than they already probably do, or they feel cornered, and they don't necessarily have an answer, or they don't know what quite to answer. So if you can start your intervention with a suicidal person by saying things like, tell me about what's making you so sad, it's a whole different kind of question than why. Why makes me think of my mother, and I think we want to try to forget our mothers when we're having this conversation and have it be less about judgment and more about bigger and broader. Think that you are like that cartoon Disney character about Dumbo, that you want to have these gigantic ears and really listen as clearly as you can. The other danger that I think we get into has to do with thinking that we know the answer. So all you're doing at this point is to show that you care. I saw a question come up, and I will go back to that question. I just want to put this in some sequence, and then we'll go back to questions. So I'm not ignoring it. The second thing we need to do, and that can vary. For some clients, we can move through show you care really quickly because someone is interested and trusts us and believes that we're going to help them, and they're going to not need a whole lot of time to feel safe. Many of the women and the men that you're working with don't feel safe. They don't feel trustworthy. They're worried about what might happen to them. Are you going to haul them off in an ambulance and lock them up at Harborview in Seattle or some other hospital, wherever you might be? So there's lots of worries about what's going to happen. So again, show you care might take several days, that over time. It might take 2.5 minutes because you already have a foundation or the person perceives you as, and they're ready to share. The second thing we need to do, again, regardless of the initials that we have after our name, so even if you're not MSW, if you're not anything fancy, because I think this is not about being fancy, it's about being able to ask questions and care. And so the really important next question is this issue of asking directly about suicide. Are you telling me that you're feeling so bad that you're thinking about dying, that you're thinking about suicide? What we can do here is to ask the question in such a way that it prevents the person from asking it or answering it. So if I were to say, are you thinking about doing something stupid, is going to get a much different response than saying, have you been thinking about suicide? If you are nervous and don't want to say the suicide word, and you hem and you haw and you say, I'm really sorry, but I have to ask you a really hard question, and I don't really want to put you off, but I'm afraid you might be offended, and I need to ask this. Again, the potential is there that the client is going to say, oh my God, she's nervous. I need to not answer this question honestly because she's going to freak out. So, again, calm, direct. I invite you, if you are interested in more training and more opportunities for practice, because if I had you for 3 hours or I had you for 2 days, I'd make you practice this. And for many people, it's the first time in training they've had to actually say those words. It's okay to ask, are you thinking about harming yourself? But clearly, we need to make sure that we're not avoiding the suicide question and only sort of pretending that, it's just a little less serious and maybe they're just going to harm themselves. The question that came up that I'm coming back to now has to do with, clients, victims, survivors worried about, they don't want to get help because what happens if I go to the hospital, if I go to counseling, and somebody, if I'm outed, that the perpetrator finds out where I am, and I, you know, to be honest with you, there's so much potential possibility for that. And so I don't want to be, I certainly don't want you to be over-promising. I don't want you to be suggesting, don't worry, don't worry. But so it really plays on you as an advocate to give as honest an answer, but also continue your advocacy when you make a referral to an emergency room. Maybe you go with them, maybe you call ahead, maybe you tell the triage nurse or the social worker on duty, I'm sending this person or I'm accompanying this woman who's very afraid that she is going to be injured and hurt and found out by her perpetrator. She's in danger not only of him, but she's in danger of ending her life. And what we have to try to do is to ensure her safety in terms of suicide, but we also want to ensure her safety in terms of confidentiality. Now, again, I'm not a Pollyanna. I absolutely don't believe that we can always ensure that, but you have a job, just like I do, to try to advocate for your client. And part of the way we do that is to, help open the gates, help ensure that the system, the resources, understand the situation that is presented to them. These are questions that we need to ask in terms of evaluating how serious the risk is. Within each of your organizations, with each of your agencies, there may be some rules, some policies and procedures already for you about, I can't go and ask these questions, I need to refer. I'm going to simply inform you of them so that you'll know. Because whether it's at the emergency room, maybe it's a master's level person in your agency who has the responsibility of going farther with suicidal people, I don't know what your rules are, but I want you to understand that there needs to be some more questioning. So if the person says, yes, I'm suicidal, I need to find out how prepared are they? Do they have a plan to end their lives? Does that plan involve a gun? Does it involve oxycodone? Does it involve using a rope? Is the answer to that question, yes, I've thought about suicide, but I don't really think I could do it. So we need to, and so you wouldn't ask them how prepared they are. You would begin to ask them about, again, the how, the when, the where, and with what. And if you can look on this slide, what you're going to see is that we've got CPR, so the mnemonic, this is the one I do remember. So current plan is the C. We want to make sure that that we understand how serious is this threat. So the issue has to do with, again, understanding the lethality, the specificity of that plan. We also want to know in the P, how desperate is this person? And I made reference, to this earlier. What is it about today? I'm going to take a drink here. What is it about today that would cause this to move to more desperation? So the CPR, the questions that you are looking for have to do with how prepared, how desperate. And finally, and really important, what are those resources? How alone does that person feel? And I think this question is so obvious so often with the folks that you are working with because they often feel alone and they don't feel like the system supports them, their family, who's there for them. So what I want you in reviewing a risk, or if that's somebody in your organization or in the emergency room, these are the kinds of questions that we have to find out. How prepared, how desperate, and how alone? And then the two additional questions that we want to find out is, how familiar? Is this a behavior they've ever done before? Is this a behavior that they've done before but never got help for? Is this a behavior that they've been involved in mental health counseling before but hated it? Are they currently in any kind of mental health counseling other than what you're providing for them? These are current plan, pain, and resources, plus the two what I call extra credit, are really important factors when we review risk. Now, the question that popped up for me, or the comment, is quite lengthy, and so I need to see if I can read it, but I've also got to keep moving ahead so we can get to the case examples. And so I may have to take a break. I'm going to move ahead to the next slide and then try to read that one. It's just very long, and I don't want to lose track, and I haven't yet learned how to talk and read at the same time. That's my next goal. So the first step, remember, there's a quiz, or not really, but the first thing you're going to do is show the person that you care about them. The second thing I want you to be able to do is ask directly, non-judgmentally, about suicide. And there's a number of follow-up questions. And the third major strategy is to get help. So, and we're going to look at this more specifically on the next slide. But before we go to that, getting help there's a variety of ways to do that. There are clients who are absolutely unwilling to go into help themselves. And you are convinced, you are concerned enough that they need help. Otherwise, they're going to end their lives. And they keep saying to you, no, 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 no. There is a system in the state of Washington that involves something called involuntary civil commitment. Some of you know that system. Some of you refer to it as MHPs or DMHPs or that. And many times we're very frustrated by that system because they don't always see the need in the same way we see it. But there is in this state the ability to detain someone against their wishes if that person believes they need to be in a hospital. So getting help might be something that is offered and provided for someone who's not willing. But there are a whole lot of issues related to that. Secondly, there's sort of this very much more passive approach we call indirect, where getting help is sort of saying, I hope you have a good day, I hope everything's okay. And honestly, I don't think you're going to be doing a lot of that. That's, unless you're working on a hotline, those of you who are having face-to-face direct contact are much more likely to be involved in something we called a cooperative approach, and that's where we're going to move to the next slide. But again, there are times, having worked at the crisis clinic here in King County, there are times that someone would call the crisis line, be suicidal, I will have talked to them, and then they will say, gosh, I feel better, thanks for listening, I think I'll go take a walk and call my mother. I don't really feel like I did a whole lot of directiveness there. I didn't have to call the MHPs by any means, and I frankly didn't even engage in a more cooperative. So let's look at the next slide where we're talking about this more cooperative approach where we're actually engaged in some contracting for a safe plan. So contracting has to do with, you know, trying to ensure verbally or in writing that the things that we are concerned about that came up on the risk review, let's talk about, for example, how prepared they are. So we want to disable that plan. So if the plan for ending their lives would involve, I'm going to take a whole pile of oxycodone, then part of our jobs, somebody, whether it's yours or whether it's someone else within your system, need to figure out how to disable that plan, which means probably taking the pills away. If we're talking about a gun, that's a different factor. If we're talking about jumping in front of a bus, that's another. So we have to keep looking at how do we disable, how do we interfere with that person carrying through with their plan, first and foremost. Secondly, we basically, in a contract or in a safe plan, we want to ask the client to promise us that they won't hurt themselves either on purpose or accidentally for a finite, specific, short time in terms of, you know, I promise, you know, can you keep a promise for, and sometimes it's 24 hours, sometimes it might be 3 days. The question just came up had to do with do I experience contracts being effective with children and youth, and yes, I do. I use them, I believe in them, and I think they're actually very effective for people of all ages. I'm going to go back to my comment that I said probably on the very first slide. Most people who are suicidal do not want to die. They want to escape or stop pain. If they perceive you as helping them with that pain of trying to hold them so that they can get through this crisis, they're much more likely to engage in a contract and to feel as though that's a source of protection or support for them. So a self-harm contract can be helpful. I do not, underscored six times, do not believe that contracts should be just pulled out of a file drawer and filled in based upon kind of this empty or this agency template. I think you have to customize it for the person that you are dealing with. Third thing in terms of a contract has to do with safety contacts. If they can't keep their promise, who are they going to talk to? Are they going to be able to call you 24 hours a day? Can they call a hotline? Can they go to the emergency room? They have to be given some number or location to go for help if they feel like as though they cannot keep that a contract with you. Now we're going to, and the fourth element here has to do with asking a person at risk of suicide not to use substance or alcohol during the period of time that they're engaged with this SAFE plan. Now, there are many folks who are abusing and using substances, and I'm not suggesting they're all going to just stop that. But I do want you to consider that this is a moment to educate about how it is that alcohol and drugs can interfere with judgment, can create a greater concern about the problems that they're experiencing. Sometimes people feel more courageous under the influence of substances. Sometimes they clearly lose judgment. So I think it is an opportunity to simply say and to educate, while you're promising me that you won't hurt yourself, could you also not use drugs or alcohol because it can interfere with your ability to think clearly? Then remember in the risk review, we asked about pain, we asked about aloneness and about resources. So let me speak to those two. If those risk factors came up very high when you were asking, the person feels alone, they don't feel like anybody cares about them, it is important to try to dig for and see if there is a resource. It truly may not be the information, you know, it may not be a mother, it may not be their husband, it may not be a mental health agency. We have to get fairly resourceful at this point in terms of resources and think about, is it a person of faith? Is it truly just the Bible that they could read? Is it a chat line on the internet? We're going to have to get very resourceful for some of our clients because we simply don't have all the things that we need for them. I'm preaching to the choir, you know that. Easing their pain. Let me just reinforce that talking to people makes them feel better most of the time. You know that. I'm only, again, reinforcing what you know. So the suicidal person often feels much better if you simply give them time to talk. Their pain will be much more extreme at the beginning than it is at the end of your conversation. And finally, sort of going and trying to reinforce what past survival skills the person has engaged in. When I feel frustrated, overwhelmed, when I feel discouraged, when I felt alone before, what have I done? And I often tell this story about myself when I was a case manager working 24 hours on at Harborview out at Mental Health, and I was on call. I did go to sleep one night, and a client woke me and said, "Sue, I can't sleep," and I very quickly went to my suggestions for what works for me. I told him, "Why don't you have a cup of tea and why don't you take a bath?" And he laughed at me and said, "I don't like tea and I don't have a tub." And I think that story reminds me so often about how quick it is for us to get into advising people what works for us individually, and what we must be able to do is try to support what works for them. So we're all about survival, whether that's in terms of violence and whether that's in terms of other-directed violence or self-directed violence. So know that a SAFE plan needs to be short-term, should be written, if you can do that, and should include these elements. And then finally, which is not on here and should be, the other part of the SAFE plan is what you will do, which is, in fact, to follow through. So if you promise them that you'll see them the next day or call them on the phone or accompany them to the emergency room, all those things you've promised need to be done. And the next slide we're looking at is a very small list of resources, but let me just say that there is a national suicide prevention hotline. You obviously have your own hotlines that you can use, but know that 800-273-TALK is a line that can be available. You've got physicians, you've got healthcare providers, some better than others, some more knowledgeable than others. Again, this is where your role as an advocate is extremely important. Going to an emergency room, but please just don't tell people necessarily to go there. If you've never been to an emergency room, visit it sometimes without a client and see what it's like to go there. How busy is it? How long would I have to wait? Would I be, strapped down to a gurney? Find out those things so, in fact, you'll have better information when you're suggesting that someone go to an emergency room. There are, of course, mental health resources. There are not enough of them. They're not always prepared to deal with domestic violence or sexual assault victims. They don't routinely ask about suicide, and they don't always routinely ask about domestic violence and a sexual assault. You've got to help them, educate them about what you know and what you think would be best for your client. There are someone who would want and benefit from talking to clergy or people of faith. Again, you're going to have to get resourceful because there simply isn't a lot out there. Okay, this is another break opportunity one more, and then we're going to literally take another pause. There's been a couple more questions that have come up. Let me just say, and I've probably talked about some of this already, as you're making referrals, as you're utilizing resources, the issue came up already of confidentiality. How can I promise that? How can I assure that? And I don't want to lead you down a path to suggest that every resource is always 100% great at that. But you do want to ensure confidentiality of the client, with the exception that if you've got a person at risk of suicide, you've got to do something. You can't simply say, I'll keep this a promise and I won't tell anybody. You have some responsibilities, your agencies have responsibility, that if you believe the person is at risk of suicide, you got to do something, and you've got to get this person to help. Is that calling? Is that taking them? Is that sending them? So understand, you've got, you can promise confidential around some things, but when there's risk to life, you cannot promise to keep that a secret. The other piece of confidentiality we talked about, which is truly what the system can offer, and technically they should, but they don't always, and it would be naive for me. I know we're all too busy, we all have too much to do, but the second bullet, I cannot underscore how important it is. You are going to be much more successful making referrals and participating in and getting what you want when, in fact, you know the providers, you know what a hospital ER looks like, what's going to happen there, and you're going to be able to have a relationship with that person. I see that there's a question. I'm going to get through these last three, and then I simply want to pause and take some water and also take your question. Everybody's got fear about referring. You've got fear. The client's got fear. The client's kids have fears. Their fear is inherent in this. Part of this is because it's a stigmatized issue. Part of that is because we don't know what the outcome is going to be. We worry that what if we don't do this right and we mess it up and the person dies. We worry about will there be any place for this person to go. We worry about will the hospital have any beds. Will they take me seriously? Fear is a part of all of this. I just want to acknowledge that. It is something you're going to have to work through. And maybe don't tell your client everything about how you're feeling so fearful. Just acknowledge that. But using your colleagues when you can to share in what feels like a very overwhelming and scary factor. We've sort of hit on the unintended consequences. I would never hope that a perpetrator would know, But I'm sure that's happened and that people feel distrusting of the system. There are times that you go to an emergency room believing that your client's at risk of suicide and they need to be in the hospital, and you don't get they don't get in. Or you get them into the hospital and they never speak to you again because they don't that you did them unfair. So there are unintended consequences, and the more that we can talk about those and think about those, the better. Let me just say, again, before I take a break, there are medications. There's lots of fear, again, about medications. Not everybody needs to be on medicine. I absolutely don't believe that. And yet there are people who truly benefit from medications. So, but my personal philosophy is that someone should be encouraged to talk about treatment, about getting help, about overcoming the taboos and the stigmas way before medication. I would venture to guess, given the kinds of folks that you and I have been working with, that they may have already been exposed to medicine and hated it, that felt it affected their sexual behavior, it affected a number of factors. They had side effects of all kinds that they didn't like, or they didn't find it to be useful, and so they already have judgment and attitudes about it. So, again, lots of reasons not to refer, and yet we're bound sometimes to refer or seek help, and I wish we could do 3 hours just on this issue. So, again, I'm going to pause, I'm going to stop, and then let me take a break. A quick break. Questions should come up here, and then the first thing I'll do is go to the person who has a question who wants to verbalize it. So hold on for 1 second. Okay, so if you have a question, you've been waiting patiently and you haven't dropped off and you want to ask it out loud, do *6 and then I can hear it. Okay, then I'm going to take the written questions. First one I can see here, it says, do you have any tips about how to talk with moms about suicidal ideation in their children and teens? Absolutely. So, again, if I'll speak to that a bit. Please feel free to go to our website. It's filled with information about how to parents. There are brochures. There are materials written there. The same 3 strategies apply. So use them with your parents. Have the parent show the child that they care about them. Be interested in their child. Secondly, don't have them be afraid of asking directly, because we need to ask that question just like you need to ask it. We teach parents to ask that question. And thirdly, to be able to, get help. So moms need to know where to go for help. Moms need to know that they can come to you or to others. But getting moms to truly be able to do the 3 steps, show you care, ask the question, and get help. So for the Youth Suicide Prevention website, it's www.YSPP. So it's the first letter of our program's name, Youth Suicide Prevention Program.org. You can order brochures that are free that from our website that it's called Recognizing and Treating Depression in Your Child. If you are working with moms of adolescents, you probably should order 100 of them. They're free, and get them in your shelters and get them in your agencies. There are brochures for free that are available in English and in Spanish about youth suicide. There are just many resources out there. You just got to go to our website and communicate with us and tell us what you need. The other question that came up, what sort of intervention do you suggest for a family member that has attempted suicide twice in 3 days unsuccessfully but is refusing to seek help? That's a very big question that I'm going to keep because there's another one here. Also from the same person, also what do you suggest as a plan of action if you feel they are staying with family members and are a threat to those family members? So let's start with the first one. So someone has made a suicide attempt several times in the past 3 days has not died and is now unwilling to seek help. So I'm suggesting the frustration here has to really do with a person who's uncooperative. I totally understand that. And if you can work with the family to help you ally with them and suggest there's only so much family can do and they need to get help. You also may need to simply call the crisis line in your community and ask them and get in touch with the mental health professional and see if there are grounds to get this person hospitalized or into some kind of care, even though they may be unwilling. If there are grounds to hospitalize, danger to self, and there is no other alternative for them but hospitalization, the mental health professional in your community can do an evaluation and determine whether they are could need to be in hospital. In terms of staying with family, again, call the mental health professionals and get a consultation. You were within your rights to do that. You identify yourself as a professional and you indicate that you have a situation. Now, my best advice for you is to use the C, the P, and the R responses. So if you asked about suicide, then you ask about plan, you ask about pain, you ask about resources, you are going to be much more successful getting the mental health professional people to take you seriously when you have covered that material and have answers to those questions. Last question, and I'm going to move ahead because we're going to get through one case example. How do we work with callers calling our crisis line whose main purpose is attention seeking? Some of our callers have disclosed that they are indeed attention-seeking. Oh, yes, I do remember many a client who would call the crisis line. They call yours, they call ours, they masturbate, they seek attention in all sorts of ways. And I think you've got to sort out whether the suicidal behavior, is this an intent to die or is this an intent to seeking help? And if there's enough need for training around help-seeking behavior and manipulation, I can't get to that today, but we could talk about and talk to Jake and talk to the coalition about whether that is training that you want. And in your evaluations that you're going to get, maybe you can comment about what more training. If that's one of them, then we have to talk about how to offer that. I'm going as fast as I can. Do I have a list of mental health providers who are trained in working with domestic violence and take clients with limited resources? No, I do not. And that fully falls back to you. You have to know your own resources in your own community. I travel the state. I work primarily in King County. I know King County resources, and the way I know that is because of the people that over the years, and I've been doing this work for a long time, I've gotten to know them. So if you are, you've got to find your own resources, and you've got to get to know those folks. So I'm being rude a bit, but I want to get to this. So here's the hard one that we're going to work on first. So Liz was molested by her grandfather when she was 5, and she was raped when she was 19 by an acquaintance. She's now 28. She's unable to keep a job. She's having problems with her roommates. She's drinking a lot, and when she's frustrated, she cuts on her arms with a razor blade. She appears depressed to you. You know her through your work as an advocate. You can be whatever, you know, you could work with her if you're a hotline person. I mean, whether she's sounding depressed or whether she is appearing depressed, and she asks you if there is any hope for her. So we can go back and forth here, but these are the things I want us to be thinking about. How do you find out if she's suicidal? So you're going to have to ask her. Some of these questions I'm going to answer, but you're not going to know unless you ask her. So but let's go back. The clues, some of the clues are there. The clues were what? She's having problems. She's having problems, but, she's drinking. Is that a clue? It might mean she's suicidal, but we don't know if it's just that. If she's having problems with her roommates, could she be suicidal? Sure. She never said she was suicidal. So remember that in this work, we've got to ask. We can't just assume. I'm going to stop for a second. Jennifer's asked a question, and apparently, Jennifer, we can only read your questions. We couldn't hear you. So if you don't mind asking it or writing it, I'll try to respond. I'm sorry, we just don't seem to know how to get to the verbal questions. So again, there's lots of, I'm going to go back to the case example, and poor Jennifer's going to have to type it in for me. There are lots of people who are presenting to you who probably have a multitude of problems, but you've got to ask them, are you feeling so bad that you're thinking about ending your life? Liz, I need to know that from you. Would I ask that before? But first I need to ask a bunch of questions that would indicate that I care about her. So remember, the first strategy is show you care. Then the second strategy is to ask if she's suicidal. If she is, who do I need to tell and what do I need to document? Really big questions. So you need to know in your own agency, in your own organization, what's in my role, what is my responsibility? Do I write an incident report? Do I tell somebody? Do I do this on my own and try to figure it out? If you don't know the answer to that question, you need to find out today. If you don't know, or if you are a supervisor on this call, it should be, here I am, I'm preaching to you, but it definitely needs to be part of orientation. If you're talking about all the policies and procedures that you have, make sure that your people know, what do I do if Liz comes my way? What resources are available for Liz? Well, we need to find out first, does she have a current plan? Does she have a grandmother? Does she have a girlfriend? Does she have children? What are her resources other than hospitalization? Because to be honest with you, hospital may not be the first place that I think about for Liz. I need to know about her pain. I need to understand the sort of what kinds of support Liz has. I need to know a bit more before I quickly say to Liz, let's go talk to the emergency room doctor. You've got to do the C and the P and the R questions in order for us to talk about what kind of resources in terms of the mental health system are available to her. Jennifer, I see your question now. I'm sorry. It was there, and then I moved on, and then I lost sight of it. So I'll get back to you. I promise. What if she refuses to get help and only wants to talk to me? So this is a really hard one because, again, you've got a relationship. If you feel as though she's not at risk and you have gone through the C and the P and the R questions, even though she said she was suicidal, and you feel like you can make a contract with her, you don't necessarily need to refer her to the mental health center or to the emergency room, but you've got to have some confidence that you've got a contract with a person who is going to come back to keep safe. You need to be able to write that somewhere. You need to be able to document that because there is some liability for you and your organization if, in fact, Liz dies and her family says, you knew this, and you didn't do anything about it. So, yes, I'd have her sign a contract for safety. I'd ask her to stop drinking. I'd try to understand what's going on for her roommates. I'd try to understand more about the cutting behavior. I'd try to understand more about what her difficulties are in terms of keeping jobs. But she's got also this massive history related to molestation in terms of the rape. And we don't know how resolved those issues are, and my guess would be, and you're probably going to say the same thing, they're not resolved, which is why we still have trouble when she's 28 years of age. So what's her willingness to get help? So Liz is a kind of person you're dealing with, but there's many more answers that we have to find, or questions that we have to find answers to. But absolutely, you would not automatically say, oh, my goodness, we need to take her to the emergency room. You're the front line here trying to assess what's her level of preparation, what's her level of desperation, what's her level of and availability of resources, Has she ever tried suicide before? And does she have a mental health history? Is she currently in care? Those are the questions that really define the suicide risk, and we have to try to get her to be as safe as possible before we focus on all the other issues, like the molestation and like the drinking and like the boyfriends, like the roommate friends. So Jennifer's question, I'm going to try to read. It's a rather long one, but I work... She works for the King County Prosecutor. I'm currently working with a client that talks about suicide, is depressed, and I suspect has chemical dependency issues. No doubt. It's common. She doesn't have a current plan. I'm glad that you know that. And says she is not currently suicidal, but if the defendant goes away to prison, she says she has nothing to live for. I believe at that point she would try and kill herself. What should I do to help her? It's a really important question. I'm sorry that it took me so long to get to it. So the issue is that you've got somebody who's feeling really vulnerable without a lot of resources. So, and the only resource she believes she has is the boyfriend. I'm assuming it's a boyfriend or at least the defendant. And so while you've got her not considering suicide, it's time to begin a conversation about what other resources are available. If he goes to prison, and be as straightforward as possible, then what can you do now, and what could you do while you're waiting for him to return? What kind of support can other people provide? She won't apparently access DV resources and has recanted the criminal case. She believes that she's responsible and that she's to blame. Boy, does fear and guilt roll in here. So I think it's enormously important that you're asking her. I applaud you for that. And sometimes we have to ask over and over and over again. And the truth is we've got to figure out, is there any other platform, any other resources, any other support that could hold her while... if this defendant goes to court, so that in fact she doesn't, take her life. I think you're going to have to keep asking her as this very volatile, tricky part of this trial comes forward, if you go to trial, related to, how do you support her? How do you deal with, who can she be with besides you and besides the defendant? I think those are probably the best things I can suggest. I'm looking at my clock realizing I'm just going to quickly look at this. You're going to see it when you get the slides at the Coalition website. So, again, another complicated, not easy. Martha is 43. She's the mother of three children. The postpartum question came up a long time ago. Here's the mother of a child who's 6 weeks old. Postpartum depression is a real phenomenon. What I tried to write, even without knowing that that question would come up, is, what do we do with the mother who's got a very young child and she's recently taken the children and left her boyfriend? They have a long history of being she has been physically abused, but now she's in the shelter for the first time. She's feeling guilty. She feels confused. She feels anxious. She feels afraid. And she wonders out loud, maybe it would be better if someone else were to raise her children. So, lots of important, we've got to figure out, how is this a woman dealing with postpartum depression? She sounds depressed, but we need to know more. So the same questions apply. How do we find out she's suicidal? You have to ask her. You need to first show her that you care. You need to figure out what's going on. She's told you some things. Who do I tell? Again, I'm going to go back to your policies. What do you need to document? Your agency should know that and should have told you that, and do what your agency suggests. If your agency doesn't know what to do, the Coalition can help you. You can go to our website, www.yspp. There are guidelines on there. Again, I can't answer the question about resources until we know what the C and the P and the R are related to her risk review. So I guess the last thing I'll say, and then I'm going to sign off, is this last comment about you need to be a support for each other. That when a person dies, when a person is suicidal, when these complicated Marthas and Liz come to our attention, we need each other. That we cannot do this work alone. And drinking Chardonnay or going to, taking a walk, those are some some healthier than other coping mechanisms, but make sure that you have a process that's built in within a formal or informal way within your organizations to get help so that you're not holding on to this frustration and this upset by yourself. So as good caregivers, you know, taking care of others, we have to also take care of ourselves. And one of the ways we need to do is get that from our peers and from our supervisors, because our clients can't be the ones to provide that. So we could go on for hours. It looks like we've just barely scratched the surface. I think Jake's going to tell you, but I'll tell you. Here we are. You're going to email. We're going to send you. Jake's going to send you a certificate. In order to get a certificate, you have to email Sandy. Write down the address, Sandy with an I, at the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence.org by next Tuesday. Put in the subject line that you want a certificate for suicide webinar. If there are more people than just you that you've got sitting around there, that I love that, but make sure all their names are on the email so they all get their certificate. One last time, we're going to post this in the recorded form and with the PowerPoint slides on the coalition's website. So you have that? So there's wscadv.org. And I hope that some of you will tune back in when we do the coalition, when we do the webinar for the coalition again on May the 7th. So with that, I'm going to hang up and pass it to Jake.
Okay, this is Jake. So that's going to wrap us up here, folks. We are at our time of an hour and a half. Thanks so much to everybody for joining us, and huge, huge thanks to Sue for coming once again to share this just incredible wealth of information with us. And just to reinforce for people, too, I know Sue mentioned it several times, YSPP.org, it's the Youth Suicide Prevention Program. They're just an incredible statewide resource. There are people throughout the state, so you can get connected with somebody in your region. Lots of more information and resources for you on that website, too, about suicide prevention and intervention and how to find out more information. So thanks again, everybody, for joining us. And the whole webinar will be available on our website, so you can look at it again. You can look at the slides. If there are people in your organization who weren't able to be on the webinar and you want them to get this information, they can actually do the training on the website via that route. And like Sue said, she'll be back again in May. So if you want to find out more about the self-harm stuff that we just scratched the surface of, come on back and join us for that too. Thanks so much.